So you heard that background. So I've been a therapist now for 6 years, and I love it. I got a master's in psychology because my previous job, well, I was a minister, had to pay the bills somehow. So I worked with brain injury survivors full time during the day, and they paid for a master's in psychology. And I said, I'll never want that, but hey, they're paying. And here I am now. I'm really grateful I had it. So enough background. And after I'm done, I'll hang out, talk and kibitz and answer questions. If you have questions during it, raise your hand because it makes it more fun to be interactive, right? So, and if you think I'm saying something wrong, let me know because it's really fun to fight together in front of other people. It's happened to me more than once. So let's just roll. Well, first of all, we live in a fallen world. And because we live in a fallen world, we have to deal with people that aren't doing well, that struggle with mental illness to varying degrees. And a lot of us personally will struggle with various forms of mental illness to varying degrees, intense grief, depression, anxiety, trauma. So we don't get through our life unbruised, right? And I want to be able to come alongside people who are at their worst with God's grace and love and minister to them. But there's certain things that work well and certain things that don't. So, and I've learned through both what has worked well for me and what hasn't. So learn from my mistakes.
Make sure they can hear you.
Yep, I asked for that. So raise your hands if you can't hear me, okay? First of all, you gotta protect your soul. If you're going into this area, working with people who are struggling mightily, it's dark and hard work. And you have to know that up front. There's a cost to pay for working with, and this is my partner in crime here. He's a trauma dog, Ripley. Sorry, Rip. And he loves people. So he's with me in sessions to help people that are traumatized, which is awesome. So I start my day as a therapist with prayer because I know I'm over my skis, right? I don't have the ability to do what I'm asked to do every day. If I do this another 20 years, I still won't have the ability because it's that complex and that challenging, but God does. So I'm comfortable with that, right? If it was up to me, I couldn't do the job. I'd quit. But I pray the Lord's Prayer. And one aspect of that I really lean into is that I want those that, now I can't say it from you. Those that do harm against me, I want forgiveness for them, but I add to me, but to those also I care for. Because I spend my days hearing horror shows of what humanity can do to each other. And I get too upset, right? Thanks, Rip. I get too upset and too rageful, and I gotta be careful because I know I'll fall into rage and anger, and that's gonna be destructive.
Right.
So I learned this in my FBI career because I worked child prostitution for 4 years, and so I've seen a lot. But what I learned was this, is that God has perfect justice and perfect mercy, and he's gonna take care of everybody,
yeah.
Right? Me too, and everyone. So I don't have to be the justice when I can't be. When I can be, I like to be in my old job, but sometimes I couldn't be. So God will take care of everything in the end. So don't hold bitterness. Don't hold anger. It's just going to destroy you.
Yeah.
You have to have really solid beliefs about how capable you are. And so the phrase I've learned is, I'm only called to be faithful and show up. I'm only called to show up and be faithful. Faithful and show up. That's it. So when I was doing child prostitution full-time for 4 years, I got destroyed by it. I was pretty bad off. I was really bad off. And I survived it, thank God, and got a lot of help to get over it. I tapped out of the child prostitution stuff. They moved me back to healthcare fraud. So a little less traumatic, right? And I got better. But you have to realize that if I'm responsible for those I work with, I'm going to be crushed by it. You're not responsible for those that are suffering that you come alongside. Mm-hmm. If you are, you'll be crushed by it. You're not. You're only called to show up and be faithful. And that one belief that I changed, it's a core belief, and I changed from what I used to believe I was responsible for others, totally made it possible for me to work, do hard things without overwhelming anxiety or trauma, right? So you have to have the correct beliefs about what you do. You're not God, right? And I don't work for God, I work with God. So I show up and be faithful, work with God, and then he's responsible for the results, and many of them we never see in this lifetime, right? You got to take care of the basics. Remember our friend Elijah in the Old Testament just defeated the prophets of Baal. Paul called down fire. People of Israel turned against the false priest. The biggest success, probably almost in human history. What did he do when there's a threat against him? He ran in fear and called out to God to die. What did God do? Did he judge him? No. He made a tree come up and said, take a nap. Get some sleep. And then an angel came and gave him a cake. What kind of cake would that have been, I imagine? Then go back to sleep. Okay, have another cake. Okay, now let's get going. You're human. If you're exhausted, if your body isn't doing well, you're not doing well. Your brain follows your body. So like Elijah, take a nap and have a cake, right? And when you do hard things, you learn or you win like a general. A general wins when he picks the time and place to battle. So you're doing hard things. You pick the time and place and be ready for it. Truth is the bottom line of everything. I love this quote. It's on my board at work. Is what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. So the thing at the base of most people's mental health struggles, there's biological, there's chemical, there's structural things, right? It's real. We're a fallen world. It's like some people are born with personality disorders, and it's like being born with cerebral palsy. They didn't ask for it, right? And other times we make a lot of choices to build things up, but ultimately below everything, your beliefs matter because your beliefs drive your feelings drive your actions. And so we're talking about truth. So when we are believing a lie at our core, like I believed I was responsible for others, that was a lie I believed to my core, which was destroying me. I replaced that lie with the truth. And the truth is God just wants me to show up and be faithful. He can do everything without, he doesn't need me for anything, which is really liberating. But he says, hey, son, give me a hand. This will be fun, right? It's like the dad driving the lawnmower and the kid sits on and he thinks he's just hanging out with dad, right? Dad's doing all the work. So as you change your beliefs about things, that's where ultimate healing comes from. And if you want to study more about this, I would recommend a guy named Dr. Dan Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L. Because before this, there's a thing called cognitive behavioral for therapy, which most people have heard of, right? So you take the belief and you change it. But what's a belief? I don't know. Do you know what a belief is, any of you? It's kind of nebulous and gray, right? It's hard to grab a hold of. So, yeah, it's like, yeah, it's hard to define it. But Dan Siegel is a brilliant psychiatrist, and he came up with it. And because of functional MRIs, we now know what happens. So don't think of a belief as some nebulous gray kind of out there thing. Think of it as a neural pathway, a habit of thought. So our beliefs are connections and neurons in our brain that we develop over time. Through experiences and beliefs. Like if you read scripture at least 4 times a week, that's a cool new study out, life is better in many ways. So you're building those beliefs, your neural pathways are knitting together in truth, right? So it's much more available to us to be able to change things when we realize that. So if my bad belief of I'm responsible for others was just a connection of neural pathways that developed through my childhood and throughout my life. That's all it is. And if I want to change a neural pathway, I stay off of it. Mm-hmm. But you can't change a belief or neural pathway without replacing it with truth. Okay. So you have to find a corresponding truth to replace it, and then you spend a lot of time on that. And you focus on it, you think about it, you study it, you share with other people, you talk about right? You build it out over time. Mm-hmm. Where your attention goes, neurons flow, connections grow, right? So when you identify a lie that's in your life, that's guiding and directing you, picture a stop sign, like, okay, I don't want you anymore. And you're going to find yourself on it because it's a habit, right? That's okay. It's a habit. But when you find yourself, I go, nope. And you go to the truth. But if it's too hard, just go to distraction. You want to starve it. Like a plant without water. We're going to starve it over time. But you have to build the truth to correspond. It sounds kind of simple, doesn't it? It is in a way. What is that? Oh. Okay. Got it? Take pictures of it if you want. I don't know if that makes it easier. Okay, here we go. I want you guys to be safe. When you're dealing with somebody in a mental health crisis, there's a possible unpredictability, possible danger. And so here's a few things I want to keep you in mind. Because you're God's children, he loves you just as much as he loves the person you're reaching out to. Mm-hmm. Don't forget that, right?
Amen.
Right. And we can take risks if we choose to, but also realize the people around you, you might be inviting into risk, and those depending on you.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. I did a safety training for YWAM over in Kona. I got to meet Lauren. Awesome guy. He was really fun. And it was really hard to train YWAMers in safety because they're all kind of martyr-y, right? The base there's like, no, we're good. And Lauren Cunningham said, no, you need this. Like, no, we're good. So they were a tough group to train. But then on the Kona base, I'm like, you got a lot of kids around here. And then you got a little buy-in because of all the other people around. So when you're dealing with somebody with mental health crisis, team approach is key. So I call it overwatch, so you can sound all technical or tactical or whatever, right? So if I'm dealing with my friend here who's really struggling today, I need to have complete focus and listen well and pay attention. I can't do that if I'm worried about somebody coming up behind me, if I'm worried about your friends. If I'm worried about, I have to have complete focus on you. Now, if I'm in an office, I can do that. But if I'm out on the street working with somebody, I can't. Unless I have a trusted team members that got my back. And if I trust them, all good. I got all my focus on you. But I can't really get any traction with somebody unless I can hyper-focus on them. And I can't do that safely unless I got overwatch. Okay. Slow down as much as you can. This stuff takes time. How are you standing? So when I'm working with somebody, this is really important. Think about this when you're working with somebody who isn't doing well. And not doing well could be couples. They're about to go fisticuffs on each other. Mm-hmm. I had a couple one time. The guy was a roid rage guy. He was high. And she just said, I'm getting divorced. And that was a bumpy session. And I got spooked. I thought we were going somewhere that time. So I had a little something to help me in case it happened. But so when I'm talking to somebody who's in mental health crisis, I don't want to be this. I don't want to be this. Right? I don't want to do anything like that. I want to have my hands in my workspace, but I don't want to stand in my Krav Maga stance because that's activating, right? Don't want to do that. So instead, we called it the Jack Benny. Really big show, right? Or if you grab a notebook, you hold it like this, right? My hands are my workspace. And realize you can move a conversation to where it should be safe. So it's really easy to say to somebody, oh, hey, I want to make sure I get everything down. I'm going to grab my notebook. Why don't we move over here? Like, you take the conversation to where you want it to happen, where it's going to be safe. Mm-hmm. Hey, I need a drink of water. Can I get you a drink of water? Or it's kind of, let's go to the shade or da-da-da-da, right? Mm-hmm. Let's go to this office. It's more private, but actually it has a better exit for you. You're putting them on the other side of a desk or something. So you pick where these conversations happen. You can do it in a very kind way. But make sure you're standing with your hands in your workspace. You never want your hands, and there's, you know, I can pretend I'm Italian, I'm not, you know. That's all good. But don't always have to your hands, because there's a safety principle called the action versus reaction principle. He's getting squirrely.
Does he need to go pee, you think, or what?
Yeah. he might.
You want me to take
it? Yeah, if you don't mind, thanks. Sorry, buddy. Normally, it settles right down. There's poop bags on there for you. He didn't think that was going to happen today, did he?
His landlord says, how can I help?
Yeah, I think he has to poop, actually. But it's like kids and dogs. You talk a lot about that kind of stuff, right? Okay. Play the what-if game before you do something. Like, you always want to be playing the what-if game. If you're working in hard areas, say you're doing street stuff or even your own office, if people get tense in there, you want to be ahead of the curve because you've thought through the scenario before you landed in it, right? You don't want the first time somebody gets explosive in front of you to be the first time you ever thought about it, right? You want to think about these things ahead of time. And trust your sixth sense. We called it the Spidey sense in the FBI, right? And it's true and real. It's because of the way God designed our brain and it's to keep us alive. And here's what I know. I used to teach this. I teach safety all the time. And a couple times in colleges, I won't name St. Thomas. There was You know, a professor stood up in front of 200 people and started challenging me when I was saying, trust your sixth sense or spidey sense. And like, well, that's your bias, da-da-da-da. And then everybody else in the room kind of rolls their eyes because I can see everybody, right? You know, so that's nice. But so we cross swords. But now I know the neurobiological truth for it. Here's what happens. When we're in fight or flight, this is a Dan Siegel thing. This is my brain fist illustration. Deep brain down here, limbic system in the middle, cognitive squiggly part on top, right? So we're getting constant flows of data into our brain, and they come up through the deep brain to our limbic first. Our limbic system has hippocampus and a bunch of parts in there. That's our early warning system. So when that hits a danger, and it can be a little bit or a lot of it, right? And our whole lifetimes, our brains store negative experiences way more than positive to keep us safe. So there's a lot of false warnings that come all the time, especially like people who survivors of trauma, right? But also there's true ones. So what happens when your brain interprets danger? It stops sending the signal to the cognitive, the thinking part. So you stop thinking. You don't think in a crisis. That's why motor memory is key. And then it shoots a signal down to the autonomic nervous system down here to the sympathetic side, which is fight or flight. So you get adrenaline, cortisol, muscles tighten, stomach shuts down, heart rate's up, respiration's up, and blood flow goes from extremity to core. It's preparing to survive an encounter. Beautiful system. We'd all be dead by the age of two if God didn't design this in for us. Seriously. We need this. So when you sense that there's a danger, it's your limbic system working through your sympathetic side of your autonomic nervous system, and you're not thinking about it yet. Now, it could be a fall, so don't punch somebody in the face because of it, right? But pay more attention. But there's a good reason why that's happening. And so next session, if you come families and couples and relationships, if your heart rate's over 100, shut up. Seriously, I have couples wear Fitbits or Apple Watches because if your heart rate's over 100, what does it mean? If you're not walking, if you're sitting still, it means you're in fight or flight and you're not thinking, you're going to say really dumb stuff to each other. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, let's talk about some trauma.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
Let's talk about trauma for a bit.
Slower.
Oh, I know. I'm getting a little amped up here.
Is your heart rate 100?
Yeah, absolutely it is. Yeah. So, okay, I'll come this way a little bit too. It'll help. We all experience traumatic events in our life. You can't get through life without it. Not every traumatic event is traumatizing, right? The difference between the two is power. So, a traumatic event that isn't traumatizing is something you wish never happened, and it's kind of a grief, right? Something that's still traumatizing means it's sitting in your limbic system and it's still alive and going now. So it's like you're reliving it all the time. And so when something gets, they ruin the word triggered, right? It's a great word, but they ruined it. So when you get activated or whatever, so something is similar to maybe the traumatizing thing you had, it kicks in here, your limbic system senses this. And what does it do? It tells you you're back in it in the moment. Yeah. And so I've seen people go and relive. They believe it's happening when they're sitting with me in the office, which is horrifying and scary. And that's where Ripley's really good to come alongside. Well, he's not trying to go to the bathroom. He's really calm, really. and then, so when that happens, we're in fight or flight again, and we're in panic attacks. I was having panic attacks a lot when I wasn't doing well after the 4 years there with the kids stuff, because my brain was interpreting things and I couldn't control it. So, but here's the great thing about healing trauma. To heal trauma, you revisit them traumatizing experiences in non-traumatizing ways. And what we want to do is move the experience from traumatizing to grief. Something that never should have happened, but it has no more power over me. It doesn't control me. It doesn't manage me, right? And you revisit it in has to be non-traumatizing. I'm not going to do immersion therapy. Like, let me horrify you here and make it worse. No. There's another tools, a bunch of tools. There's something called art. Not art, because I'm no good at art. accelerated resolution therapy. It's an eye movement, kind of like EMDR, if you've heard of it, but it's more gentle, yeah. Right? And super, it's like scary effective.
What's it called?
Art. Accelerated resolution therapy. I work at Teen Challenge now. My office, Rockbridge, is kind of an offshoot of Teen Challenge. We don't do the chem depth stuff, but a lot of us are trained in art, and we keep doing more trainings because it's really effective. I've seen some really cool things with that. I do TFCBT, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a narrative form designed for kids, but I do with adults too. And some people just want to talk about it. I'm like, you do you, and we'll see how it goes. Sometimes we'll talk in third person. We'll do it very calmly and gently. I have to land the plane at the end of the session where we're not traumatized. I have to time things very carefully, right? At the end of the session, I go, what's the worst thing ever happened to you? You know, no. You got to land gentle. So I've seen this work. I mean, this is what I do for a living now. I sit with people that have unspeakable horrors that I could never imagine before I'd done the job. And we work through them. And it's always easier when people have faith. But then they ask, what?
Why
would a loving God allow this to happen? Yeah. I spend a lot of time on that question.
Yeah.
So, and there's good answers for it. But here's a little hint. I normally, when people are in the moment, I might say I have answers that I figured out where I'm confident philosophically, theologically, that there's reasons, but that's not for today.
Yeah.
I just want to be with you in the grief. Yeah. And the sorrow and the trauma, right? Don't, yeah, you gotta pick your time. It's not, and some people say, what is it? Then we'll talk about it. And so I've wrestled with this quite a bit. So you need to figure out what you believe about why is there so much darkness and pain and suffering in this world if God's a loving God. I have my ideas. I believe I'm pretty solid on it. I'm always learning more and looking for more, but that's trauma. Here's the beautiful thing. So let me give you some books on trauma that you can read. Excellent books. First one is, it's called The Choice by Dr. Edith Eger, E-G-E-R. She has a bunch of YouTubes. She wrote her book when she was 90.
Nice.
Holocaust survivor.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah, Dr. Edith Eger, E-G-E-R, The Choice. My last slide will have it up there, too. The Choice. And she wrote it at 90. She's a Holocaust survivor, became a therapist in her 50s, and is in her 90s still posting on Facebook. And she is such a lovely soul. I wish I could meet her someday. She's that one person I'll probably never meet, but boy, it'd be something. She's up there with like Corey Ten Boom type of people. So she's love, and she's a lot of good on YouTube. You can find her speaking is just so life-giving. So love that on trauma. Bessel van der Kolk, it'll be on my last slide too. Don't have to worry. The Body Keeps the Score. It's kind of the textbook of it all. He's crabby, you know, but he's good. And the one thing that a lot of trauma therapy is heading to that I'm not comfortable with, which Bessel would be comfortable with, like I know him, Bessel, yeah, is psychedelics. I'm not there. I don't like it. I have lots of reasons I don't. But when you read about trauma therapy out there, it's one thing that's popping up more and more. But I don't think it's a good idea. But if you read Bessel and things, just take that. But he has a lot of good information. He's a wonderful researcher. Okay, here's some suicide stuff. How many people have dealt with people who are suicidal? Yeah. I should have started with this. If I say anything here that's activating for you, I apologize. Feel free to step out. I should have started that way because we all have been through, like I told you some of my stuff, we've all been through a lot and some people through more than others. So apologize for not saying that earlier. Okay, suicide. Can you convince somebody not to kill themselves?
No.
If somebody's determined to kill themselves, can you stop them?
No.
So it's good to believe that. If somebody, if you have the courage and you're willing to suffer alongside somebody and work with them in those hardest moments and they kill themselves, are you responsible?
No.
Will you feel responsible? Yes.
Probably.
Yeah. So I know I have a risk of that in my career, and I know I'm not responsible, but I will feel responsible. Mm-hmm. I lost a couple of clients to overdoses so far. I don't feel as responsible for that. I'm not, but watch it. You just know you're going to need some good care if that happens, okay? One of the thanks. Oh. Oh, we needed that, didn't we? All right. Okay. When somebody comes to you about suicide, it's really good not to be upset and shocked. I mean, it's nice when you be calm about something and not shocked. Like, okay. If I go, that makes it worse, right? So I've done it enough, so I'm not really shocked. And most people that talk about suicide don't kill themselves. In fact, it's probably a good sign they're talking. I'm more nervous about people that don't talk. Okay? So you can always ask some. If I ask somebody, are you planning on killing yourself? Is that okay? Always okay, because they're not going to go, I wasn't, but that's a great idea. Right? It's not going to happen. And they're going to say, no. Now, here's a neat thing. Like, I got a lot of confessions. Like, that's why I thought I could be a good therapist, because I got a lot of confessions in the bureau. It's basically the same thing, right? I'm convincing people that mental health is a good thing or going to prison is a good thing, right? Either way. But if I was to ask somebody, are you going to commit suicide? And they said, why would you ask that? I go, okay, we got something here, right? Yeah. Same way if I asked you, did you rob the bank? You should say, no. What are you talking about? That's crazy. Or why are you asking me? Yeah. You robbed the bank, right? Yeah. Try with your kids. It works wonderfully. Yeah. Also ask them, what should happen to somebody that broke the vase or whatever? Nothing. You did it. Okay, so then I try to go to, why are you still alive? I love that question as a starting point because it's a positive. Why are you still here? If you've had these thoughts, and that probably not didn't just start today, it's probably been going on for quite a while. Why are you still alive? So I like that a lot, and they'll give you a clue. And why do you think how do most people answer that question? I can't do it to someone else. Yeah. Right? I think that keeps more people alive than anything else. There's all these, you know, tricks or questions you can use. I learned as a negotiator. Why make a decision today? You can make it any other day. Like all these, and those are okay. But I think the best one is, what would it do to everybody else? Mm-hmm. You know, is there any? And then I've started doing this, which my other therapists don't agree with necessarily in the office. I heard on a podcast this really cool story about a Canadian special forces that was super suicidal. And the one thing that kept him alive was their therapist, who's the only person they really trusted, saying, "You can't do that to me. I haven't lost somebody. I can't go through that. You can't do it to me. I care too much." So I do that. I'll tell people, and some people go, "Oh!" I'm like, "Well, it's real." Like, you know. So I'll even say, if they're having trouble figuring out who cares, I'm like, "I care." Yeah. And you would destroy me. You can't do that to me. Yeah. You know. And then other people. So I think that's the thing that really helps people stay alive. Do they have a plan? Yeah, I'm gonna jump off a building. I want to jump off the IDS center. The security leaves the door open on the third. You get the specificity. If it's something specific, it makes me super scared. Yeah. If something's a little nebulous, I feel a little more comfortable, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I recently asked somebody to take a gun out of their house. Like, it's too easy and too simple when you're feeling down. I asked somebody to take a gun out of their house because it's too easy and too simple. Saying, yeah, I get my therapist voice. I start to, yeah. I do. I have a therapist voice. Yeah. So call for help. Is there everything wrong with saying, let's go get evaluated? Because you're not going to convince them to commit suicide if they go to the hospital, right? But there's no such thing as a 72-hour hold anymore. It might be a 4-hour hold. Or maybe they'll be there for weeks, you know. But chances are it'll be a very short visit. But you can always do that, right? I don't want people feeling like they left anything on the table. Like, don't be shy about it. You can do that. It'll be okay. Get people to help you with it. And the other thing I like a lot, which we'll talk about here soon, is meaning. So Viktor Frankl's one of my favorites on meaning. Oh, look at that. I didn't even realize it came right there. So if somebody has meaning in their life, I feel much safer about them not killing themselves. But people that are meaningless, it's really scary. I've had clients that were had no meaning. The universe is a big joke. I never got any traction with it. I don't know how you do that, how you live that way. And if you help people identify meaning, they're going to be okay. Help them identify the meaning they have and can have and live towards, they'll be okay. God designed our brains for meaning. Not for achieving, but for pursuing. Dr. Arthur Brooks pointed that out wonderfully. And he has a brand new book out. It's sitting on my table. I will get to it when I'm in school for full time for a semester. Don't do that. But excellent stuff. So when we pursue meaning, we get dopamine pops, the reward chemical, right? Same thing when you fall in love is dopamine, right? Dopamine's a great thing. We get dopamine pops when we do that. And that encourages us to keep going. We don't get the big dopamine hits when we finish. So I've done some races, like I've done one marathon, one and done. That's enough, right? A couple halves. But the joy of it, the meaning of it is pursuing and getting ready. Adding miles, getting gear, making plans. That's the fun of it. And when you cross the line and get the medal or whatever, it's like, oh, that's nice. But it's not the pursuit, right? So all of us should be pursuing multiple meanings throughout our life. If you're not pursuing meanings, things are too hard. And there's many ways that we can identify meanings that we pursue. And the best on this is Viktor Frankl. His book is Man's Search for Meaning. I highly recommend everybody read it. But kind of like with Edith Eggers' book, I got to warn you, the front part's hard, right? It's the Holocaust. Like Viktor Frankl, you know, he went to the Holocaust as a psychiatrist. Probably one of the most brilliant minds of the last century. He was brilliant, young. You know, he's like Doogie Howser of his day. And he changed so many lives. But he's Jewish. And one day, the Gestapo came, and they took his wife, who was pregnant with the first child, and his parents and him all different places. He never saw him again. And his massive work he was building to share this concept of man's search for meaning is the key thing. His wife sold it into his coat for him because they knew something was going to happen. They didn't know this was going to happen. The death camps, they didn't know that. And then when he went to Auschwitz, what happens? They strip you naked and burn everything. So he lost everything in a moment. Everything. But what did he do? He said to himself, I'm not going to be a slave. I'm going to be a doctor. And he made a almost four-year study. He survived in hell of himself, the other inmates, and the guards. And he wrote this book afterwards. Wow. It punches hard. And he's so fun because he's all over YouTube too, but they're some of the old ones, like the black and whites where they're smoking. Tell me, doctor. Yes. It's really cool. So, but it changed my life, this wisdom that if we pursue meaning, we'll be okay. And he has this math equation, which is phenomenal, and it's D equals S minus M. Okay, despair equals suffering minus meaning. So my next tattoo, I want to get that somewhere here, because I can point to it. Look, don't despair. Despair equals suffering minus meaning. Now, who here will not suffer in their lifetime? Right, we're all going to suffer, but none of us have to be in despair if we have meaning. And to really punch that point home, he talks about when observing when people go into the gas chambers, they know they're going to death. There were people in that group comforting the others with hymns and songs and prayers and Jewish prayers and Christian prayers. They're having meaning up to the moment and through to death. Meaning is always possible, and it fights despair. If you find yourself despairing, find meaning. And when we're believers, it's so much easier, right? But it works for everybody. Everybody needs meaning in their life. If you're a nihilist, ouch, you know, it just doesn't work. Life doesn't work. What's a nihilist? A nihilist, that there's no meaning in the world. Life's a big joke. Yeah. You know, we're meat machines or meat computers.
Prayer and I mean there's not like a specific, because it's a hard one to you approach them, or where do you start with them?
Yeah, and I've worked with nihilists, you know, as a therapist. And I'm always upfront with my background. You know, I see lots of people aren't Christians, and I adapt. I'm not going to push something with them because that's not my role as a therapist.
Yeah.
But they know my life and my beliefs. And a lot of times I'll say, well, here's what I believe about it, mm-hmm. right? And I hope that the way I live and believe influences. Mm-hmm. Like, we have influence on people, right? And so I use my influence. And they're God's. Everybody's God's child, whether they realize it or not.
Amen.
So I have compassion on them. They don't realize yet. And I do the truth in gentle ways, but I also do it in wise ways that I know work with neural pathways. And, you know, there's lots of room to run. But sometimes we plant seeds. Mm-hmm. Sometimes Apollos, you know, or and then God brings a harvest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I plant seeds. I don't ever know if it works or not. But one of my nihilists was lying about where he lived to see me. And I knew it. What do you do? Because he was a Zoom thing, and I knew he was out of state, which I'm not allowed, but he kept lying about it. So that's a good sign, huh?
Yes.
So, but yeah, that was tricky. I'm like, I know you're lying. How was the weather this weekend? You know, I'm like,
So much snow.
Yeah. Okay, lots of great books there. We're just flying fast. Good podcast up there. Communication. Now, communication is key. We all have something called mirroring neurons. When you're born, the only way you learn anything is by imitation. God designed our brains to imitate. So little ones, you ever get that sense that somebody's looking at you and turn around, some kid's just drilling you, right? Always in church, just staring. That's how we learn language and everything. Now, here's the neat thing. Those mirroring neurons stay with us till when? We're dead, right? So our whole life, we're compelled to imitate the people we're with. So what does that mean when we communicate? It means if somebody's accelerated and amped up with us, our brain is saying, go, 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 right? But if we can fight that and stay calm, we're telling their brains, calm, 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 calm. Your job is to be calm. And you have to fight it. But if you know the truth, it really works well. It works great with kids. Like Dan's, if anybody has kids here, Dan Siegel's stuff on kids is phenomenal. I've been a way better parent. I got two in their 30s and one mid-20s, and I wish I knew this stuff. Dan Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L. S-I-E-G-E-L. So when they flip their lids, you know, fight or flight, they can't help it. They don't have a prefrontal cortex at all, right? And they're just, I didn't read green M&M. It's life-altering, And it is for them. That's okay. It's normal, right? But instead, if I can come along and just stay calm with them and not give them the green M&M, right? I'm not going to do that, but stay calm and explain, your brain's just upset, but I'm calm. You can be calm, too. And I've done it with clients on the autism spectrum. I had one guy that could get very violent, like, and he's huge and young. It's so scary. But I would say, I'm getting a little upset. I'm going to do some breathing. You want to join me? No! I'm like, I'm going to do it, though. So do some relaxing breathing. And it just calms the room down. Just by me proving I'm calm, calms the room down. So be calm. You got to listen, which is super hard to do. But it's super intoxicating when somebody listens to you. Because we don't get listened to ever.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that gets in the way of listening a lot of times is planning your next phrase. If they say this, like playing chess, don't do that. Just be in the moment and listen. And I don't have time here, but there's a thing called active listening skills, and that's all designed around proving you're listening. And if you're good with active listening skills, you don't have to worry about what to say. Yeah, the hardest thing I've ever done, I don't know. One of the hardest things I've ever had to do as a chaplain, we were chaplains too for a while, my wife and I, was do death notifications. Like, what's worse than telling somebody, yes, hey, your life's over. So here's another communication skill that comes from that, is memorize your opening line for a hard conversation. You don't want to go and go, right? So when you're going to talk to somebody about something hard, which you will working with people with mental illness, know exactly what you're saying the first line or two. And then you can relax, because you have active listening skills if you develop them, and then just roll with it. Wherever they go, you're fine. It's better to be interested than interesting. Isn't that cool?
Mm-hmm.
That's a Zig Ziglar. Yeah. It's so simple. I could talk for a paragraph and just sum up with that. So According to Zig Ziglar, and he's right on that one. So no, everybody's self-centered. Sorry, you're all self-centered, right? We're born that way because we have to survive that way. That's how we survive. So we're all self-centered. And that's fine. God can work with that. We can work with that. If we know it, it's a good tool for us. And so if I'm interested in you, it's way more appealing and rapport building than for me to try to be interesting to you. Mm-hmm. Like, I've done this and that. Like, no. What's your story? What's about you? And that's what's intoxicating. So be interested. Don't worry about being interesting. They don't care. They're self-centered, right? You don't either. You're self-centered too. We all are. You got to have rapport before you build influence. The only way you get to do some change in some life is build rapport. How do you build rapport? Focus on what's important to them. So as an FBI negotiator, we call it hooks and landmines. I want to go to your hooks and I want to avoid your landmines. Now, if you step on a landmine, that's okay because I don't know you, but don't step on it twice because that's disrespectful. I bring up mom or something. You're like, okay, don't talk about mother. Don't talk about mother. Everybody in the world has hooks. And when we talk about them, it's intoxicating. Like, I have clients I know really well, and they'll start talking about my stuff. I'm like, stop it. I'm the therapist, because I find myself, oh, yeah, I love this Indian restaurant, you know. So, and if I had more time here, I don't. We're rushing a bit. Is one thing I do to find hooks is I look at people, because we all portray to the world what's important to us by what we wear and how we present ourselves. So I love people that have ink. Oh, these are kind of hard. I got ink. And when people have ink, it's so cool to say, hey, that's pretty cool ink. Where'd you get it? What's the story? Because in the story might be they were drunk, and that's a story you could talk about too, right? But usually it has some meaning to it, you know? I did 20 years in prison. Oh, cool. Yeah, that's awesome. Or I retired from the FBI and got Michael the Archangel, right? So everything. What they wore, like you got American flag hat, that tells me something, sports kind of stuff, and even somebody's wearing an NDSU, is that, I don't, pretty good peepers, kind of thing. You might say, oh, I got a Goodwill. I'm like, oh, cool, I shop at Goodwill too, you know, or shoes, oh, you're a runner, you know. So be observant of who you're with, and they're giving you clues all the time, and you look for the hooks. If you grab somebody's hooks and talk about that, you're gonna be okay. Like, as a therapist, I don't start being therapist-y. I got to have you build some rapport with me. I got to be real and a human being and interact with you that way. I want to know what's important to you and then interact on that. So you have to build rapport first. Nothing good happens without rapport. Be authentic, but try not to be shocked, right? It's really good when you're not shocked at things. And I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but you can't shock me anymore with everything in life. And that's probably not the best. So here's some de-escalation. So when somebody's amped up, right, you want to de-escalate. And here's a couple things that works really well. Out of the blue question. I did this with security guards. We came up with this. And so if somebody's like, I want to see the pastor. I need to talk to the pastor right now. You know, you want to interrupt that perseveration. They're amping up, right, and building up. You want to interrupt that. So a good way is out of the blue question that's calm and kind. Hey, I'm so thirsty right now, I can barely even think. I need a drink of water. You want one too? Right? You're interrupting that. You know, where the security guard's like, hey, where are you parked? They're giving tickets to everybody. I want you to get a ticket. Right? So you want to interrupt with a kindness. Interrupt that perseveration. But you can only do that if you have in your motor memory questions built in you can use. You have to know ahead of time places to go or you won't go there because you're in fight or flight when somebody's amped up in front of you, right? So that's why motor memory is so important, to build in a couple kind questions. Hey, my back's hurting me. It's hard standing here. Do you want to sit down instead? So you interrupt. Oh, hey, I want to make notes of this so I make sure I get everything right. Let me get a notebook. So there's all sorts of ways to do it, but you want to interrupt the perseveration, not let it just roll. But you don't want to say, sir, right? Because mirroring neurons, right? Unless you're arresting them, they can do that. Help somebody find safe face somehow. You know, and that might just be simply as, hey, let's go over here where it's not so many people around. Yeah. Right? You want to find the way to save face. Or I need to talk to the college president. I need to talk to the senior pastor. I need to talk to, like, Well, we can't. That's going to be hard to do right now. But how about write down exactly what you want? I'll get that note to him personally. Yeah. Give him something if you can. Know what you need to accomplish. Because what you need to accomplish might be keep things calm enough till the police come and escort them off the property. Yeah. That might be your goal in that situation. Or your goal might be to build rapport for an ongoing relationship. And that will determine how far and what you do. So know what you need to accomplish when you're entering these hard things. People can only think about one thing at a time. So if they're amped up on something, if you can get them engaged in some type of hook you can find, it's hard to talk about the thing they're amped up on. Oh, geez, this isn't working. Okay. Okay. Another really good thing to have for de-escalation, it's not written down up there, is the red tape excuse. When somebody's asking for something from you that you can't give them or won't give them, never talk about somebody above you as a person. Well, the pastor said, I'm not the pastor. You're done, right? If there's another entity. But if you say, you know, there's this policy or something, I'm not even sure, but hey, let's keep talking since we're talking. So that's a total nobody's going to take a hostage, are they? Because I just gave you some inside information. So hold it dear. Don't take a hostage. That I'm going to tell you can't talk to the boss. You can't talk to the chief. I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say there's a bunch of people running around out there. I don't know who's making decisions. But since we're talking, there's policies. I use this as a therapist when I have to talk about bills and stuff. Like, hey, it's not me. I hate doing this stuff. There's some policies. Yeah. Right? It's a beautiful thing. Okay, here's all the active listening skills. I'm only going to do two of them for you, the two that work the best and are most important with mental illness, okay? Number one, and the most important one, is emotion labeling. That's how you see it in the literature. Think about it as emotion questioning. It works better. So emotion questioning. So this is for when somebody's delusional. If somebody's delusional, picture it as a big boulder between you and them. And delusions can mean everything from the NSA planted bugs in my head, they're using satellite technology to track me, which I've heard many times, so maybe it's true. I really have. That's a big theme out there. Or it can be what people have told me, all cops are bastards. And obviously I'm not agreeing with that, and that's a delusion in my eyes, right? So never agree with and never disagree with the delusion. If I agree with the delusion, yeah, the NSA, I hate when they do that. Well, I'm lying and they're going to figure it out because I don't know about the Illuminati behind the whole thing, right? Because this is their life and I'm just playing pretend. Mm-hmm. They'll see through it. Don't lie. Mm-hmm. Don't disagree. I'm not going to say that's not true because what does that lose for me? What do I lose? No rapport, I'm done. Instead, I'm going to go around. So it's a boulder, right? The NSA or all whatever's between. I'm going to go around it and instead ask how it's affecting them. So like the NSA, like, huh, do you feel like everybody's up in your business? That would freak me out, man. Are you scared over that? Or how are you dealing with that? I didn't agree. I didn't disagree. If you get close to how it's affecting them, you win. For all cops are bastards. Do you feel like there's no justice? Like, how do you deal with that? You know, that we can talk about. So whenever somebody's delusional, and delusional can be a teenager thinking that they should be able to have their own car at 16 when they turn 16, have a Ferrari or whatever, right? That's a delusion. And you can do more with your own kids, be a little firmer, but it's always better to kind of work around it. Like, why do you think that's so? You know? I might disagree with that one. So that's a bad illustration. Take that back. Sorry. Okay, forgiveness. We got to forgive. We got to forgive. I'm going to fly here. We could do 3 hours. You got 3 hours? No. Okay. Study Corrie Ten Boom on forgiveness. Edith Eger, her biggest thing when you read her, she had to forgive herself. She didn't forgive herself for years because, you read it's in the story. The Lord's Prayer. Forgive those who trespass against me. As I forgive those who trespass, forgive me. I can't do it in front of public. Okay, I do it every day though. And those I care for, I add in on that one. God's justice is perfect. Forgiveness is something you do for yourself. Unforgiveness, it's going to mess up your relationships. So many divorces come from that. Big griefs, just some. There's a thing called the grief circle I can't do, but you can find it online. It's a beautiful way to look at grief. You need to oscillate in and out of grief, right? You can't, that's a thing. We got to spend time in it and oscillate out. It's really key. C.S. Lewis, A Grief Observed. Wow, what a book. What a book. And I give that to people if I think it will work for them later on in the grief process. But I've given away many copies. It's a beautiful look at grief and the power of it. Lament, Dr. Elizabeth Hall, you can look her up, talks about lamenting. It's a great three-step thing. Cry out to God for your suffering, ask God for what you need, and thank God for his help. So, yeah, we're not going to do that. Okay, some resources in your pocket. PDR.net, that's every medication that's out there. It's free and online. You can study. Somebody's staying on that medication, you can look up and see what it does or what not taking it does. MayoClinic.org. You know the Mayo Clinic, yeah? It's the best website out there. Here's some books. I'll leave this up for you. Woo! We flew, friends. That was like a graduate level course in, or I don't know what it was, but yeah, what questions?
Can you please just go back to the attachment slide so we can snap a picture of it?
Yes, ma'am. Sorry for that. Yep, attachment's key. How do you know if a kid's securely attached? Take them to the playground. If they run out and play but occasionally look back to make sure you're still there, we're good. If they just take off and run, don't look back, spooky. If they don't leave your side, it's spooky. Great little test. And how we attach to our families is how we attach to God. How can, you know, God's this loving father, we hear, and then, but your father was anything but. So it's something you have to work through. Not to compare the two. Mm-hmm. Oh, and if you're working with people like this, please have an expert in your back pocket. Who do you call when you need a question answered? What do I do with this? Who do you send people to? And when you send people, make sure you have a few. I have 10 on my waiting list. Like, we're busy out there. So make sure you have good resources to get people to.
Good way to find resources like
that? Word of mouth. Okay. Other people in your community that trust people, because not everybody's equal.
Yep.
Right? In any job. Like, you don't want to go to the wrong barber, right? It could be pretty bad. You don't want to go to the wrong therapist. Same thing.
Yep.
And the key with finding the right therapist is, do you have rapport and work well with them? I'm not for everybody. You know, you got to find the one you click with and keep going until you find the one you click with that does good work. All right. You guys are awesome. Question?
I'm sorry. One more. Can you repeat the kid running off on the playground again thing, please?
Yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah. So if you take a kid to a playground and they run and play but check back at you occasionally, make sure you're still there, that's good.
Okay.
If they run and take off and never look at you, that's spooky.
That's okay.
And if they never leave your side because they're too scared, that's spooky.
Okay.
General principles. Here, right? They might just be having a bad day.